This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is the Rob Call Bottom Up Radio Show, Progressive Liberal Talk Radio.
In-depth interviews with leading progressives and the smartest people in the world. Listen at 8 p.m. Wednesday nights at Progressive Radio Network.
It's not liberal, it's not conservative, it's progressive. The truth that empowers, right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. We're here to talk about the issues that can impact our lives in a positive way, providing solutions to many of our most troubling problems. Today, we're going to look at the latest on health and healing. We're going to explore, for example, everything that we can think about to be honest about soft drinks, because a lot of people drink them every day and sometimes several times a day, thinking they couldn't be harmful. The government wouldn't allow it. Think again. I'll give you the latest from Boston University on that. And then a Chinese herb has anti-aging potential, and we're going to give you the latest on what that single Chinese herb is. Also, we're going to show you about nutrients offer hope to stop a deadly march towards cirrhosis and liver cancer. Oregon State University is going to tell us which nutrients can help protect our liver. Also, cycling or walking to and from work is linked to a substantial health benefit. University of Glasgow, which is in Scotland, and a lot more on health and healing. Then last evening, I received a call from my office that on Tucker Carlson, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was talking about vaccine safety. Robert is a very articulate person. He is a scholarly lawyer. He does his homework. And he was arguing about the mercury in vaccines and the number of vaccines that he had versus what his children had. But he went overboard explaining how he is pro-vaccine. Tucker was in one of those situations where he was simply clueless. I'll let you hear what he had to say. I'll play that clip, and then I'll respond. I have a commentary that hopefully the people who are confused about to being pro or anti-vax, so which vaccines, this will help address that. Also, my hope is that someone will send that specific clip to Tucker Carlson. He impresses me as a person with an open mind, willing to entertain different points of view, and hopefully if he is convinced of an argument, he then may use that as his new starting point, and I'm hopeful he will do that. Also, because it is a special day for those of us who honor and respect the environment, Earth Day, the second part of our program, I'm setting aside for a Dr. Kroger, the world's leading authority on trees and how trees can help us in the healing process. And we'll be talking with her. I think you'll enjoy this extremely gifted woman talking about a subject that we all need to know more about. So that's what we have in store for you. So let's begin. There's also a new article published in Cancer Research from Texas A&M University showing that what is called spermidine, S-P-E-R-M-I-D-I-N-E, that's a compound found in mushrooms and soy and legumes and corn and whole grains may prevent liver fibrosis and also carcinoma of the liver, which leads to, you know, liver cancer. And that's important because it also shows that it can prolong lifespan. That's good too. And, quote, it's a dramatic increase in lifespan of animal models, as much as 25%. Wow. Now, in human terms, that would mean that instead of, quote, living to about 81, the average person would be over 100, end quote. So you would have to understand how to get it in concentrated amounts, but at least it's showing that it's in there. And that may be one of the reasons that people who are on a plant-based diet live longer lives. The latest science I have, because I'm doing a major film on this as we speak, is about 9 years. Now, that is not take into account exercise or specific nutrients. And by the way, I'm going to be spending a little over 2 hours on an upcoming webinar discussing the latest in the science of anti-aging, how to live a longer life. I believe that everyone listening right now, no matter what your age, even if you were 90, you could extend that lifespan measurably and the quality of your life significantly if we applied the principles I'm going to be sharing. It is too much to share in 5 or 10 minutes. It will take a full 2 hours plus another hour of a film on top of that. So you're talking about 3 hours. The last one I did was 2 hours and 45 minutes. This will be a little longer. It'll be in about 3 weeks. But now we're knowing that there are nutrients that we have not historically known about in soy, and we're not talking about genetically engineered soy, we're talking about organic, as a part of an overall diet, not by itself. And the sulforaphane and other nutrients like indole-3-carbinol that are in broccoli, but most people don't eat broccoli, and most people don't eat soy. But if you live in the Orient, you do. Well, is that one of the reasons that people in the Orient have better health, in spite of the fact that they smoke more? So it's important that we understand that when science comes along, it shows us that something like a spermidine can help extend lifespan and protect our livers. The gee whiz, is that a principle concept in a diet? Meaning, do you have a bad diet and just take a supplement? That doesn't work. Or do you have a good diet and then supplement on top of that? That does work. So just giving you the latest. Now, from Boston University and Swinburne University in Australia, it's about soft drinks. A friend of mine, for almost 30 years of our friendship, every time we met, he would do nothing but consume soft drinks. He didn't drink any alcohol, didn't do drugs, but he sat a lot, and he was up late at night. And so he was constantly needing some kind of a sugar fix. And no matter how many times I suggested, are you aware of the science behind soft drinks? His excuse was, couldn't be that bad. I said, it is bad. And one time I brought him over all the studies on soft drinks, both sugar-free and sugared, with a high fructose corn syrup or the artificially sweetened. And I said, both are bad for you. Both. So either way you go, you're going to hurt yourself. He later developed cancer, and he died from the cancer. And it was sad because he was smarter than the choices he made. He was a very brilliant man about most things. This is the latest, because I'm sure all of you have tended to that experience of having a family member or a close friend make choices that they would never have made in any other part of their life. And yet, when it came to their health or their relationships, those are generally the two places people screw up, they made bad choices. Well, drinking at least one, that's it, just one artificially sweetened beverage a day was associated with almost a 300% increase in the risk of developing a stroke or dementia compared to those who drank artificially sweetened beverages less than once a week. So that's a big, big difference. And that's in the peer-reviewed journal Stroke. That's the publication of the American Heart Association. So people who are long-term artificial sweetener drinkers, like diabetics and pre-diabetics, people who are overweight, people on weight programs, that's not good. You're going to pay a price for that. So give up all artificial sweeteners. Now, if you want to have an iced tea, try green tea or jasmine tea or lemongrass tea or hibiscus tea. Any of them, or all of them are good. And just put 1 to 2 drops of stevia sweetener. That will sweeten it to anyone's taste. And there's nothing wrong with stevia. In fact, it actually has medicinal value. And then from Qingdao University in China comes an article about a Chinese herb. And I'll spell it for you because these are all available generally in Chinatown. It's a perennial herb, and it's abundant in a couple areas of the Shenyang provinces of China. It's a non-toxic traditional Chinese herb, and it's been used in tonics and to help strengthen the body and nourish the spleen and the lungs. Chuan, Chuan, Mission, Mishen, and the second word is Violaceum. It helps improve antioxidant activity and increases free radical scavenging capability. So what this means is as we age, our body has less antioxidants. With less antioxidants, we have more free radicals. And we have more free radicals in stimulating the body also to create more pro-inflammatory cytokines. So the more cytokine activity you have, the more pain you're going to have, the more inflammation, the more swelling, the more redness. So by taking anything that can trap the free radicals, you help prevent the swelling and the pain and inflammation. Now, if someone comes to see me and they have full-blown AIDS, or they have full-blown stage 4 cancer, or they have an ulcerating leg, asking them to have a glass of orange juice is meaningless. But that's where most people get stuck. It is what I came up with a principle, it's called the laws of compensation, which means that to the degree you have any injury, genetic, surgical, trauma, accident, bacterial, viral, parasitic, no matter what whatever the cause, you have to exceed the damage at the cellular level with that which is healing, which then becomes the predominant energy. And it's all about energy at that point, not just nutrients. We only focus in the West on nutrients. In the East, they focus upon the energy, of which the nutrients are but one of the factors. And therefore, you have a dominant healing energy in the healing system. So anyhow, that can help. Also, there's another nutrient that offers hope to stop the deadly march towards cirrhosis. According to Oregon State University, it's the omega-3 fatty acids. That's good, because I'm trying to get everyone on those to help them. This was published in PLOS One, and what they found is it was significant, since millions of people in the developed world try and fail to sustain weight loss and eat an optimal diet. So it's the DHA fraction of the omega-3 fatty acids, and it's very important to our stopping the progression of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is a life-threatening problem. It's as life-threatening as cirrhosis and liver cancer. So that's to get your omega-3 fatty acids. My suggestion is about 1,500 milligrams in the morning and another 1,500 milligrams in the afternoon. Also, according to the University of Glasgow, bicycling or walking to and from work is linked to substantial health benefits. Now, active commuting by bicycle is associated with a substantial decrease in the risk of death from all causes, including cancer and cardiovascular disease, compared to non-active commuting by car or public transportation. This was published in the British Medical Journal. In fact, walking is associated with a lower risk of cardiovascular disease. So that's terrific. So walk to work, walk home from work. If you're on a subway, get off at a particular place where you can get about 2 miles of walk in. I'm recommending 3 miles a day for the average person to start. If you did 3 miles in the morning, another 3 miles in the evening, you're doing yourself a lot of good. And from another national research center, they found, published in the Peer Journal Oncology, they found that ginkgo biloba has anti-tumor properties, and there's a lot of evidence for it. So they worked on carcinoma here and found out that it made a big difference in this liver cancer. So some of the latest makes a big difference. Oh, and by the way, a meta-analysis, meaning many studies done at the University of Graz in Germany, show that vitamin D deficiency will increase your risk of death during any 10-year median period. So if you don't have enough vitamin D, D3, you're more likely to die sooner. They analyzed 26,916 participants from 8 prospective studies, and that's what they found. So get your vitamin D. And hops helps fight breast cancer and menopausal symptoms. And that's good. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us. Now let's go to a clip, audio clip from Tucker Carlson last night, 10:30, interviewing Robert Kennedy Jr. Then I will give you my comments.
Well, the vast majority of medical experts insist that vaccines are generally safe, that there is no link between vaccines and autism, and that is widely accepted, but not universally. President Trump has expressed interest in investigating the matter further, vaccine safety. If he does, he has at least one supporter from a prominent Democratic family. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. met earlier this year with the president to discuss the possibility of forming a commission to investigate the safety of vaccines. We spoke to him about that topic recently. Watch. So this is such a taboo subject that I think a lot of people would hesitate even to bring it up. But I've read a lot that you've written on it. I don't agree with all of it, but I don't think you're crazy. You're not anti-vaccine. You say you vaccinate your own children. But you have concerns. Tell me first what the reaction is when you tell people you're skeptical of the vaccine regimen in the United States.
Well, like you said, I'm pro-vaccine. I've never said anything anti-vaccine, but I read the science, and the science is very clear that some of the vaccines, and what you have to understand is that the vaccine regimen changed dramatically around 1989. The reason it changed, Tucker, is that Congress, drowning in pharmaceutical industry money, did something they've never done for any other industry. They gave blanket legal immunity to all the vaccine companies so that no matter how sloppy the line protocol calls, no matter how absent the quality control, no matter how toxic the ingredient or egregious the injury to your child, you cannot sue them. So there's no depositions, there's no discovery, there's no class action suits. All of a sudden, vaccines became enormously profitable.
From that point, from 89, when the law passed.
And in 87, it was implemented, and then there was a gold rush by the pharmaceutical industry to add new vaccines to the schedule. So I got 3 vaccines, and I was fully compliant. I'm 63 years old. My children got 69 doses of 16 vaccines to be compliant. And a lot of these vaccines aren't even for communicable, you know, casually communicable diseases like hepatitis B, which comes from unprotected sex, or, you know, using sharing needles. Why do we give that to a child the first day of their life? And it was loaded with mercury.
And we do give that to children.
We continue to give it to them. The mercury has been taken out of 3 vaccines in this country, but it remains in the flu vaccine, 48 million flu vaccines, and it's in vaccines all over the world, and it is the most potent neurotoxin known to man that is not radioactive. How can we inject that into a child? If you take that vaccine vial and break it, you have to dispose of that as hazardous waste. You have to evacuate the building. Why would we take that substance and inject it into a
little
baby?
So the argument, as you know, is that group immunity, herd immunity, is what you're searching for. And yes, there are downsides, but
herd immunity is, you know, when they talk about herd immunity, they're talking about casually contagious diseases like measles.
Right.
Last month, a group of very prestigious scientists with a robust study of African children studied the DBT, diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine.
Yeah.
Which is the most widely distributed vaccine in the world. Virtually every kid in Africa gets it. But they found they did a vaccinated versus unvaccinated study, which has never been done. And what they found was that the kids who did not get the vaccine, the kids who got the vaccine, the little babies, were 10 times as likely to die in the next 2 months as the kids who did not. And what they concluded was, this study was funded by the Danish government, and again, these people are very bulletproof scientists. They said that that vaccine is killing more people than diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis combined. So we need to do those cost-benefit analyses on every vaccine.
So why, and this is a final question, but why has the point that you're making that doesn't seem crazy been so discredited? Could it be because the spokesman for that point of view tend to be actresses from Hollywood who don't seem, or actors who don't seem to know much about the topic and are against all vaccinations? That has,
you know, I think that cohort is out there, but it's very, very small. And I think, like, I'm called anti-vax all the time because the pharmaceutical industry is so powerful, both with the media. They give $5.4 billion a year to the media. And they've gotten rid of the lawyers, so there's no legal interest in those cases. And they really have been able to control the debate and silence people like me. And I'm very grateful to you for having the courage to allow me on this show and talk and say, this is the second show in 10 years that's allowed me to talk about this, the other one being Bill Maher, which doesn't take advertising.
I just think it's interesting. And above all, I think you ought to be allowed to ask legitimate questions without being attacked, because I think that's the basis of democracy.
I mean,
thank you.
We ought to
okay.
be having a response.
Bring it down. All right. First of all, I appreciate Robert F. Kennedy going on there to talk about that. Now, here's the contradiction, and I'd like Tucker to address this, if he would, please. You just said that people should have an opportunity to go on the air to discuss an issue, to debate the issue, without being attacked. Both of you just attacked all the parents out there, of which there are many, including several million, who have reported their children were normal till they were vaccinated, and then they were no longer normal. We have had over $3.5 billion given out to children and their parents for the vaccine proven damage. We also have an industry that has no ability to acknowledge its mistakes, its missteps. But it goes beyond that. You mentioned herd immunity. In point of fact, herd immunity has never been scientifically proven. I can show you study after study that those who were fully vaccinated ended up coming down with a very condition like measles or chickenpox for which they were vaccinated. Well, if it were efficacious, if getting vaccinated with the complete a set of vaccines needed was protective, then why weren't those people protected? So it is a matter of scholarship. I've spent more than 14,000 hours researching it. Here's what I believe Tucker Carlson and Robert Kennedy should know. Robert's argument is about mercury. and he is absolutely on point and accurate. But the assumption then is as long as you take the Merck route of a vaccine, everything else is fine. No, it is not. We've just finished a major film. It's in post-production now. I'll be premiering it sometime this summer. And in it, we interview leading toxicologist. He made the comment that, well, if you dropped a vial of mercury, you would have to have special clothing and you would have to dispose of it in a particular dangerous, toxic place. Well, I could also show you that's true with aluminum. And aluminum is in greater quantities, including in the hepatitis B vaccine that they get, where there's absolutely no justification because show me the child that's born with sexually transmitted hepatitis or was intravenous drug-using hepatitis. You won't. And therefore, why give it? Because it makes profit. Because it's a runaway industry where they cannot be held accountable for any downside. During the past two decades, the anti-vaccination movement has increased dramatically in the United States. To suggest, Carl Tucker, that, well, it's just some, you know, you were actually referring to Jenny McCarthy, and hers is a good case, but she is one spokesperson. And if she wasn't at the time a partner, life partner with the comedian, then would she have, Jim Carrey, would she have had the same opportunity to be on the media? I doubt it. If she was just a normal homemaker who would love to have an opportunity to take their case to the public, would they have been given that opportunity? They rarely, if ever, are. The only time you hear of these people, no matter what their background, they could be a lawyer, they could be a physician. I've interviewed multiple women who were physicians who gave their own child the vaccines and had developed diseases or developed different conditions, and then they couldn't get anyone to pay attention to them, and that was frustrating to them. In fact, in one room, I filmed 10 women, all physicians, who all gave their children the vaccines that would later end up causing them to have an impairment of life. So then the suggestion is that only if you're famous or dating someone who's famous will you get attention, but then you're just kind of like a little tiny asterisk out there. You don't represent the public. In point of fact, there are millions of people who have legitimate grievances and have documentation to prove that their children were vaccine damaged. We do not have any place right now in the United States where they can present their evidence and therefore have a collection of that evidence to take forward and stop all mandatory vaccinations. So what does it say when we don't even allow the debate? And he said he's only been on two shows in the last 10 years. Well, he was on my show. We gave him an opportunity to talk, and he was able to say what he had to say. And it was my show that spent 7 hours in one special on one day, and 1 hour of that was me debating the man who had attacked and caused the license to be revoked of Andrew Wakefield. And why is it that none of this is ever mentioned, that we have a lot of evidence? We have documentaries, we have articles. Richard Gale, one of our scholars in residence, myself, have published over 42 articles, all fully footnoted. Why aren't they being read by people in the media like Tucker to realize that there's a lot of good science supporting the reasons not to vaccinate? So understand that the reasons that people are opposed to mandatory vaccine today is directly due to the spikes in rates of neurological and developmental disorders, such as autism spectrum disorder and ADHD diagnosis and other mental disorders. However, there is nothing new about the emergence of a postmodern awareness of vaccines' risk and the questioning of their efficacy and safety. And since the time of Edward Jenner's smallpox vaccine in the early 19th century, there has been strong vocal opposition against the practice and even stronger resistance to government vaccination mandates. The famous British naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace and a friend of Charles Darwin co-founded one of the first large popular anti-vaccine movements in England. And then the author and British parliamentarian George Bernard Shaw was adamant that vaccine science was a barbaric invention that would eventually create havoc in the health of children. He was right. One anti-vaccine demonstration held in 1885 in the city of Leicester in England drew 100,000 protesters. Now, mind you, based upon population at that time compared to today, that'd be over 1 million people today. And other famous anti-vaccine spokespersons included Mahatma Gandhi and the Nobel laureate Bertrand Russell. In the U.S., by 1880, there was already vibrant anti-vaccination organizations around the nation. Most important were the Anti-Vaccine Society of America, the New England Anti-Compulsory Vaccine League, the Anti-Vaccine League of New York City. And these organizations distributed literature and pamphlets warning of vaccine risks and examples of permanent injuries and multiple vaccine-induced deaths. And they fought vigorous court battles and also in state legislatures. And by the turn of the century, the anti-vaccinations movement succeeded in repealing mandatory vaccines in California, Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, Utah, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. And in Milwaukee, Montreal, riots were instigated to remove vaccine bills with extraordinary success. And during the course of post-World War II, 20th century, more and more Americans placed their faith in the advances of medical science and in the efficacy of vaccines in particular. It was believed that American medicine and the federal government would never permit any medical procedure to enter the market that would harm children. Indeed, there were horrible vaccines administered, such as the Salmonella pertussis and the contaminated polio vaccine with the carcinogenic substance SV40 simian virus. 90 million were given that vaccine. Countless children were injured, but either the association between the illness and the vaccinations were not made public, or the injuries were easily forgiven. After the passage of the Vaccine Injury Compensation Act by Ronald Reagan in 1986, the pharmaceutical and biotech industries went on a bonanza of inventing and marketing new vaccines. Could they prove efficacy? Could they prove cures? Could they prove 100% prevention? Absolutely not. It was garbage science. And no longer were the drug makers to be held accountable for vaccine-induced injuries. Subsequently, by the mid-1990s, as most vaccines entered the market, a steady rise in neurological disorders was being noted in children under 5 years of age. And autism was starting to enter the popular vocabulary as more parents were witnessing their small children regressing neurologically at the time of the vaccination. And with the help of early media coverage and the internet, more and more parents and doctors were becoming aware of the epidemic in our midst. And subsequently, the new anti-vaccine movement was born. It was not born from a few people who had no background in science or medicine or public health. We have a full spectrum of doctors, pediatricians, molecular biologists, virologists, and other scientists who've come forth to speak against widespread vaccination and the challenge to faulty wisdom of the CDC, the corruption of the CDC and the FDA. Now, who are these people? So, Tucker, if you want to bring on people who really have a better understanding of the complete fiasco and fraud of public health science when it comes to vaccine, Dr. David, and these are medical doctors, Dr. David Ayoub, Dr. Tony Bark, Dr. Teresa Binstock, Dr. Kelly Brogan, Professor Brian Hooker, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, Dr. Joseph Marcola, Dr. Tatiana Obhansky, Dr. Lawrence Polvitsky, Dr. Christopher Ploth, Dr. Dev Rana, Dr. Michael Schachter, Professor Stephanie Seneff at MIT, Dr. Matt Stoller, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, Professor Luja Tomlevich, a great toxicologist, Dr. Julian Whitaker. And also, if you want to speak with attorneys and medical researchers who have studied the independent research and good journalists, Roman Bristenick, Hillary Butler, Christine England, James Grundvig, Louise Habakas, Zen Honeycutt, Jeffrey Jackson, Sarah G., Robert Krakow, Diana Miller, Alan Phillips, Vera Schreibner, Vera Shavrev, Jim Turner, and several of those are lawyers who've studied it and brought cases and won. And there are also groups, the Campaign Against Fraudulent Medical Research, the International Coalition for Safe Medicine, the International Medical Council on Vaccines, Medical Veritas, National Vaccine Information Center, Tracking Vaccinations, Truth About Gardasil, Vax Truth, Vaccine 9/11, Vaccine Liberation, Vaccine Risk Awareness Network, Vaccine News, Vaccine Resistance Movement, Vaccine Rights. So you see, it's not just a few people who you would say are irrelevant. there's a great many of us. And a lot of science, a lot of people who've done thousands of hours of research and who would be more than happy to come on your program and to share their information. And if you wish to debate and bring on Paul Offit, one of the pro-vaccine people, please do so. We always encourage open debates so the public can see both sides. Back in a moment. Please stay with me. In just about 2 minutes, we're going to go to our guest, Diana Burstford Kroeger. And but before then, something new today. And anytime I spend this much time over a year creating something new that I believe will benefit people, I just want to give you a heads up on it. And what is one of the biggest problems in America today? Sleep. Interrupted sleep. People waking up, people can't get to sleep, people are not getting a good night's sleep, and we know the consequences of having regular poor sleep. It hits your immune system, hits your energy level, and we also know the benefits of a good night's sleep. And we know that we have to be exercising, dealing with stress appropriately, having lots of good liquids, healthy clean water, good juices, and a good plant-based diet. Those are the foundational issues. Also, we have to be careful to make sure there's no ambient noise. We can wear earplugs. If there's light, we can wear eye patches made out of silk or satin to protect us from the light coming through. We can write down our problems before we go to bed that we want to address the next day so we don't take that to bed with us. Not having foods to eat, which raise our blood sugar before we go to bed, all those impact. But something else impacts, and that is the right nutrients. So here's my new invention called Sleep Stuff, just today, available. Passion flower extract, valerian extract, chamomile extract, ashwagandha extract, melatonin, L-theanine, hops extract, reishi mushroom, lipase, amylase, protease, inulin, jasmine, also griffonia extract, which is 5-hydroxytryptophan, GABA, magnesium citrate, lemon balm, skullcap, catnip. Whoa, that is Sleep Stuff. Let me give you the number to call so you can place an order. It just arrived about an hour ago, so I wanted to share it with you. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Now, my guest is a power in the field because she's wise, she's calm, she's focused, she's what you would call the wise woman of the trees. And she is she's in Ontario, Canada, and she is she speaks for the trees. She's done the science on the trees. She's a scientist. She's a botanical scientist. She's a medical biochemist. She's a Canadian-Irish researcher. And she's written extensively on the molecular biology of trees, their medicinal properties, tree social interactions in the forest and with other life forms, forest conservation. And in the past, she has held science posts with the Canadian Department of Agriculture and the University of Ottawa School of Medicine. She is a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, and she was named World Visionary by Utney Reader. And she is also the author of The Sweetness of a Simple Life, and also a documentary about Diane's work across many nations exploring the secrets of northern forest, The Call of the Forest. And her, you can also look at that at calltheforest.ca. Person listening right now, it may be somewhat challenging for them to perceive trees, let alone a collective forest, as being sentient. Interestingly, the Middle Eastern prophet of sorts, Manai, who was the founder of the second century religion, Manichaeism, had his revelation by hearing the emotional screams of yeast and bread being baked in the ovens. And the religion of Zarathustra which was a precursor to Temple Judaism and Christianity, had a highly evolved respect for the sentience permeating the natural world that is similar to indigenous peoples today.
Yeah.
We have scientific findings, many originating from your own research, that reveals the intelligence of trees and plants, or photointelligence, that is analogous to the characteristics we endow humans. So how would you convince someone about the sentient qualities and awareness of a tree?
Well, I would ask every single one of my listeners to do this. If sometime in your life you are a little depressed, okay, you take a walk by the river, and the river, a river, any river, and the river should be flowing. And if you come across a willow tree, any kind of willow tree, and I would ask you to sit by the bank of the river in the presence of a willow tree. And I would ask you to do forest bathing in the presence of that willow tree. And the willow produces many, many forms of salicylic acid. And to you, that is equivalent to aspirin. About 22 different forms, aldehydes, all different kinds, into the atmosphere and into the water. Stay there for 15 minutes. Straighten up your back. Breathe deeply so that you're breathing with your diaphragm. And get that good solution of salicylates into your body. Breathe and relax. And as you're doing that, your cortisol levels go down. It means that you're in full relaxation. And I would ask you to meditate into zero, into nothing, or meditate into some happy place or happy thing that has happened to you. And you will find at the end of 15 minutes that your depression has gone, or that your loneliness or bereavement has gone. Now, after that, I want you to think about something. The DNA in your body, everybody knows about DNA, and everybody knows that it's in a helical form. DNA really, in some ways, is a witness of the divine. And that is what the ancient peoples were aware of. They were aware of this by observation. But now, in the last very short while, in academia, in the world of science, we know that there is a DNA in all trees, and it is almost equivalent to your DNA, with the exception of what's known as two small bases on that DNA. You and the tree are almost identical. And in fact, if you and I were in a biochemical argument, the tree is almost superior to you because it can produce so many more compounds. It is truly a biochemical furnace, and that's what you're sitting next to. Now we know that. Now we know that most of the medicines, 60% of the medicines on the planet, come from trees, things like taxane, taxopherols. So you can look at a tree and be aware of what the tree is doing for you by way of a handshake. Let's think about this. You are breathing out carbon dioxide and the tree breathes it in. You require oxygen and the tree is supplying it. In the case of the willow, you are a little depressed because you're low and you don't feel so great and maybe you've had a bad love affair, God knows what. The tree will satisfy those feelings in you. And then you look at the green of the tree. Again, your cortisol goes down. And think in terms of the silence within the tree, or the silence within any forest, or the cathedral of any forest. And the forest will walk to you, walk in you, and walk through you. And you will find that you are more elevated as a human being. Just go do that experiment.
Thank you. I often look at a guest as a wonderful opportunity through whose eyes we can see the countries and how they critique the events and conditions happening in the United States. Now, you're Irish, you're Canadian, mm-hmm. and you've certainly been observing the regressive efforts by the Trump White House to destroy whatever environmental, ecological, and conservation protections that may stand between the greed of private interest and any chance to tackle the challenges of climate change and restoring a natural environment. In fact, under Trump, we're taking giant steps at a cheetah's pace backwards from where we should be headed. How dangerous are Trump's policies to tear down more forest, remove regulations that might protect land from toxic pollution, withdraw the U.S. from climate agreements, and deny climate change outright? And how does the current administration and its minions represent what I consider the worst aspects of human hubris as the so-called superior creature that rules over the planet?
Well, there are two answers, two of Diana's answers to that one. First of all, and I really seriously mean this, we mean it not just for the Americans, because the Americans are the leaders in the world, let's face it. I mean, you've got some brilliant people there. Not some brilliant people, you've got a heck of a pile of brilliant people there. We need to have a discussion about greed. The moneylenders are in the temple. All of us know that. So we need a discussion about greed. We need a discussion about equity. And it is not good enough for me to have the poor so terribly poor. That's number one. Number two, my attitude to what is happening in the United States is a little frightening for me. I'm just a timid little woman, really. That's all I am. But I look at it from another point of view. I think that it is wonderful what he's doing, because what he's doing is exposing the belly of people. And what is happening, they're going to find the things that are going to happen to them. They're going to start thinking about the environment. They're going to start thinking about the rape of the environment. They're going to start thinking about the jobs that will not come. They're going to think about the quality of life they have. And they're going to think about all of the great things that the United States has done, and they will not be repeated. And it is a shame for the rest of the world. We look at what's happening with great fear in our hearts, and I can speak for everybody that I've talked to all across the world. But I think what's going to happen is a wake-up call. People are going to start thinking, and then people are going to remember they have the ability to vote, and they will vote well the next time.
Our century is already being defined by a constant, never-ending quest for human new technological solutions to tackle the problems created by the previous human technological solutions. The industrial civilization and capitalism has opened us to the Anthropocene age, but now we believe it will be geoengineering or more nuclear power plants that will save us. And there are huge investments and untold profits to be made by placing our faith into the knowledge of humanity's ingenuity rather than the wisdom of nature and what nature is telling us. So speak a little more about the institutions of science that are now failing us and further perpetrating the problems being brought about by climate change and environmental destruction.
Well, geoengineering is a global experiment, and really it's genocide. Because what it is they, the people who are doing this, the majority of them don't care about human life. And they know that so many people will die under the geoengineering propositions that are going out there right now. And that goes for many, many other arenas. They really don't care, so long as they make money. But the ordinary people, the people like you and me, we have to care. Because we do not know enough. There is not enough knowledge in the world to do any form of geoengineering right now. We do know that a butterfly on one part of the world in the chaos theory can produce real chaos right here at home. We do know that. And Ben, what was your other question?
No, you actually answered both. Thank you.
Yeah.
You noted that even foreign ambassadors to Canada are becoming aware of the urgent need to restore our global forest. Now, I've seen in the last 2 years in different countries, Nepal, in India, in
Bhutan.
Pakistan, Bhutan, I've seen that people are planting hundreds of thousands, even millions of trees. These are not the government doing it. These are citizens doing it. And they're doing it with such a reverence, not just for now, but for future generations. And the American media doesn't give a single line of type or a single moment for us to know this. Could you talk about what people are doing around the world that shows that they care and they're actually part of the solution?
They are part of the solution, and in Bhutan, they are carbon negative. There's so many trees planted in Bhutan, and the people are behaving in such a simplistic way. The sweetness of a simple life comes from that, comes from the Dalai Lama, that kind of thinking. That's how they're living their life, and they're carbon negative. So we do not have enough riches in the world to throw them all away. We don't have that. So in different countries, different places, they are putting in dowry trees. They're putting in trees so that the girlies, when they get married, will have money in their pocket so they can conduct a good life. In Germany, they're doing designs on trees so as to withstand climate change, so as to withstand the excessive moisture that is in snow and is in rain, horrendous rainfalls that are due to happen and have been happening. They are redesigning certain stands of trees to withstand that. In other countries, in England, they're putting in 2-acre forests. They're protecting their forests. In Ireland, I'm scientifically behind, replanting the great woods of Ochty, the great woods of the last High King of Ireland. Now, Canada is remiss and the United States is remiss because everything has a dollar value. And no, not everything does have a dollar value. You should look out over your borders. This goes for Canadians and it goes for Americans to look to other places and to see what great things they're doing. And you're right, Gary, they are doing these things with great reverence. They are planting the trees with great reverence because they know that the trees are the salvation of the planet. In the ancient times, the forests were called the mantle of the poor.
There is a very poor man in India who decades ago decided to devote his life to reforestation, planting trees. He had no means, but he had desire, and he had motivation, and he had spiritual grounding. Today, he has taken an area that was deforested, and it's 1,200 acres. I do not know how many trees he has planted in that, but I would imagine be over 60,000 trees. He did it himself, one person.
Yeah.
Now, back during the Great Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had what was called the CCC, the Civil Conservation Commission. He would go into a community, the federal government would, and hire people who live there who were otherwise poor to plant trees and hedgerows. And we had not learned a lesson because of the great soil erosion. We were not respecting the crops that were diverse. Instead, we were monotheistic in one crop, whether it was wheat or corn. We wouldn't grow anything else. And then in the wintertime, we wouldn't grow a cover crop. As a result, the snow and rain would crack the ground in huge amounts, as much as a ton per acre would run off and go into the Mississippi. Today, at the base of the Mississippi, you have the consequences of not having a mine for conservation. You have the largest dead zone in the world. It's larger than the state of New Jersey. I went down there to film it for my documentary, and nothing lives in it that requires oxygen because there is no oxygen, and we have over 400 of these dead zones, and yet there are places, Bhutan you were referring to, and also in Africa, small villages are redoing sustainable agriculture using natural systems, not pesticides, not nitrogen-based fertilizers, not genetically engineered seeds. And in India, at the base of the Himalayas, Vandana Shiva is doing a magnificent job of planting thousands of variety of of different food to bring them back. There were 1,200 different types of papaya alone, we're down to two or three. So talk about what you're seeing individuals do and what we need to do in Canada and the United States today.
Well, let's talk to people in houses and let's talk to the urban people. You can look after your forests. And by the way, Roosevelt, who was the most wonderful man, I think, he was an extraordinary person. Let's go back to him for a minute. The species that he planted were called Gleditsia triacanthos, honey locusts. And America had a terrible, terrible time, terrible drought, and you lost lots and lots of your topsoil, and there was starvation. People had enormous unemployment numbers. They were rolling unemployment, really, really poor people. It was just a shocking situation. And Roosevelt ordered millions and millions of these Gleditsia trees to be put in. But as well as that, he did another extraordinary thing. What he did is he had breeding, and this is genetic breeding, cross hybrid ordinary breeding of these Gleditsia triacanthos to produce seed pods on these trees that had super high amounts of sugar in them. And these were used to feed cattle. They were used to do all kinds of things. And in fact, they also made a very high quality bread, which made people much slimmer. It was not a fattening kind of bread. So he did all kinds of really marvelous things. And actually, I think we can do this again. It would be so exciting to do this again. But, you know, what you're talking about is what Vandana Shiva is doing. She's trying to bring biodiversity back. She's trying to do what E.O. Wilson in Harvard, you have a great treasure in Harvard, E.O. Wilson, Professor E.O. Wilson, who coined the word biodiversity. She's trying to bring that back, and indeed I am too. So between all of us, we can do a great deal across the planet, and I think it'll be tremendously exciting to do this. For me, personally, putting in the Great Woods of Opti, we've got loads and loads of Irish farmers agreeing to do this, to put in Brian Boru's tree, and that is the Quercus robur, the great, great Quercus, the great oak of Ireland. And people can eat these acorns. These are anti-famine trees. I mean, this is really, really exciting to do. And it is the only thing we have on the planet, in a way. We have nature. And nature is always twisting and turning and showing us and teaching us. It is the greatest teacher in the world for all of us, as a matter of fact, if we were to look at it. Now, I mean, you can't commodify nature, and this is what's happening. What's the value of an ecosystem? What's the value of a forest? What's the value of your daughter's life? What's the value of your son's life? Sorry, baby. They have no value. These are beyond value. These things are bound with boundless love. We love the birds that come in. We love nature around us. I mean, fresh water. Who of us can do without fresh water? So if you don't have forests, you will not have fresh water. So it is to value the great things that we have around us by way of nature. And there are a few people on the planet doing extraordinary things, but we are increasing in our numbers of people who are following us. We are increasing in what we are doing, and it is going to be absolutely magnificent.
I agree. I don't know if there's a real solution for the trajectory of humanity, the way it's headed. I'm talking about the majority of people. Mm-hmm. An early 20th century Sufi teacher once replied after being asked whether he was an optimist or pessimist. He said, "I'm an optimist, but an optimist with opened eyes. And to be an optimist with closed eyes is very dangerous." And a lot of people today are very flippant. If I ask them just innocent questions, tell me what you know that you as an individual could do to help lessen global problems. They would say nothing. I don't know. I would say if you stopped eating animals of any kind or anything comes from an animal, that represents 18% of the methane gas going into the atmosphere. And methane is not equal to carbon dioxide. It's many times greater in its intensity to create global warming. In fact, if in 1 year we stopped eating animals, and we have 80 billion animals on the planet right now, that we're raising to eat, that would be more carbon that we would save than if all planes, trains, buses, and cars were not driven. I'm sorry, but I'm looking at the clock and we're out of time. I will bring Diana Burchford Kroger back on an upcoming program. It's just our contribution to a wonderful day, Earth Day. So I want to thank all of you for listening. So we'll be back on our next program with a whole lot more to share with you. Have a nice day, everyone.